You're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 18, Shots Fired. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Well, it has been a minute, has it not? Before we get into today's episode, there are a few things I want to mention. First, back in September, I did another guest spot on a podcast. This one was Revolutionary Left Radio. I had a blast recording my episode, which was basically a speed run through the Russian Revolution. All the material we covered here in 17 episodes got condensed down to 2.5 hours. Since I've been on a bit of a break here, if you feel you need a refresher on the revolution, I recommend listening to that episode. Rev Left Radio is available everywhere you get your podcasts. I also want to say thank you to Brett O'Shea, the host of Rev Left Radio, for having me on his show. I have been a big fan of Rev Left and all of Brett's work for many years. Brett is one of the most principled, intelligent, curious, compassionate, and powerful voices on the left in the United States today. If you do not know Brett and his shows, Rev Left is only one of 4 different podcasts in which he has taken part. I cannot recommend them enough. And again, Brett, thank you. Next, I have an update on my Patreon-exclusive interviews with former citizens of the Soviet Union. I have finally recorded all 6 interviews I have planned, and am currently working on translating them to English. This is proving to be much slower going than I anticipated, due to everything else I am doing, both for the show and in my personal life. But I am excited to bring the words of those whose history we've been discussing to you all, and I hope to have these episodes done in the coming weeks. I will let you all know when I have a firm publishing date. Okay. We left off on the triumph of the October Revolution, and now we start our journey into the aftermath of that triumph and run-up to the Civil War. Although, as we will see by the end of today, exactly when the Civil War starts is a matter of some debate, and there is a strong case to be made that this interim period which I am delineating here between the October Revolution and the Civil War does not actually exist. There are many important topics to cover before we move decisively into the Civil War period. Because of this, we are going to switch up the structure of the episodes a little bit. So far, we have been going in chronological order through the events that unfolded between February and October. But now, so much is going to be happening all at the same time that I decided it makes more sense to tackle each major point of inquiry on its own. This way, even if chronologically we end up overlapping and going back over the same days on the calendar a few times, conceptually, each topic will be self-contained, so that if you want to know what happened with, say, the Constituent Assembly, you only have to listen to the one episode. So, what exactly are the major points of inquiry we will be discussing? Well, today we are talking about the immediate attempts made by opponents of the Bolsheviks in the aftermath of the Soviet Revolution to turn back the clock and undo the events of the 21st to the 26th of October in Petrograd. Next, we will examine in depth the formation of the new Soviet government and the ways in which the Bolsheviks delivered, or at least tried to deliver, on many of the promises contained in their party platform. After that, we will discuss the formation of the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission for the Struggle with Counter-Revolution and Sabotage, known universally as the Cheka. We will, of course, go over the fate of the Constituent Assembly. We will start our examination of the nationalities question, especially as it pertains to the impending Civil War. We will discuss the starts of both the Red and White Terrors, their causes, their goals, and their relationship to each other. Then comes the signing of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty in late February, early March 1918, where Russia's participation in World War I at last comes to a close. And finally, we will have a prologue to the Civil War, where, similar to Episode 3 way back when, we will introduce the major players and battle lines, so that we will be ready with the who, what, where, and why for when the fighting starts. With that roadmap now laid out, let us begin. Despite the warm glow in which we left the Bolsheviks and the Soviets in the early morning hours of the 26th of October, the truth was, while the new Soviet government enjoyed the broad majority support of the masses of workers in Petrograd and across the country, the new Soviet authority was immediately challenged. There were sections of the peasantry and soldiery, and even, as we will see, sections of the proletariat, that were not immediately enamored with the new government or the actions of the Bolshevik Party. All this would serve as a basis upon which those opposed to the Bolsheviks would claim the legitimacy to challenge their new government. These challenges generally were of two natures: either a concerted attempt to force the Bolsheviks to share power with the bourgeoisie, or an all-out drive to take power back entirely into the hands of the bourgeoisie and aristocracy by force, and do away with the Bolsheviks completely. As we will see in this episode and the next, the struggle of the Bolsheviks and Soviet forces to beat back these early military challenges is intimately related to the struggle to form a Soviet government. There are a couple of reasons why we are separating out these two facets of the struggle, though. The first is, to keep everything manageable. Trying to include everything all at once would be unwieldy. Second of all, I think the struggles in Petrograd and Moscow to defeat the immediate reactionary waves deserve to be examined in detail, which means they should be examined separately. And third, the process of forming the Soviet government is full of zigs and zags, with a multitude of views being expressed from all involved. However, there is a general correlation between the military struggle and the political one. As the military struggle deepens, calls are heard from among moderate Bolsheviks for compromise with the bourgeoisie, and from the Mensheviks, SRs, and cadets for excluding the Bolsheviks altogether from any new government. But once the military struggle is decided in favor of the Soviet forces, the calculus for the two sides changes so that the more hardline Bolsheviks, those opposed to unity with the obviously counter-revolutionary parties, end up prevailing over their moderate comrades, while the Mensheviks and SRs are forced to walk back their own hardline injunction against the Bolsheviks and try for a new Soviet-based coalition government with them. Again, we will get into all that next time, but in order to understand the political struggle, we need to understand the military struggle, as the latter provides much-needed context for understanding the former. It is precisely this context that is almost always stripped from the narratives of Bolshevik actions in forming the new government. We are often presented with a narrative that, once they took power, the Bolsheviks went on a mad, violent, anti-democratic rampage because they were always going to do that, because that is just what Bolsheviks and Marxists and communists do. But with this context, even if one still believes the actions of the Bolsheviks were incorrect, at the very least, one can see that the Bolsheviks were motivated not by a lust for power and violence, but by a sense of self-preservation, an imperative not to betray the masses who followed them, and a drive to protect all they had achieved and were still trying to achieve in the revolution. As dawn broke on the 26th of October, the bourgeoisie in Russia found itself deprived of political power. In their minds, though, this was only temporary. Indeed, remember, what the Bolsheviks are doing here has, at this point in human history, never been done before. The closest approximation was the Paris Commune, and we all know how temporary that was and how it ended. So it was not at all outside the realm of possibility that the Bolsheviks would only turn out to be a flash in the pan, as it were, an historical anomaly that could safely be ignored by posterity once the bourgeoisie retook what was rightfully theirs. There were certainly plenty of Mensheviks, right SRs, cadets, and others who thought so, and were not shy about sharing their opinions. John Reed reports in 10 Days That Shook the World that out in the city, In streetcars and on corners, the middle and upper classes could be heard berating the workers for supporting the Bolsheviks, denouncing the Bolsheviks as a bunch of radical thugs, proudly declaring there was no way this rabble would be able to hold on to power for longer than a few days. And as such, some were even turning their attention to what would happen once the disorganized, dirty, uneducated Bolsheviks and their worker constituents failed and, quote, order was restored. And if you think I am exaggerating about how openly dismissive and disrespectful some were in talking about the Bolsheviks and the working class, or the open disdain and revulsion they had for the very idea of the workers and soldiers rising up to run the affairs of state, go read 10 Days yourself. John Reed was somehow everywhere during this time, both in and around Petrograd, and his records of such sentiments are numerous and firsthand. Or, take this for example. Tony Cliff includes on the very first page of the first chapter of his book, Revolution Besieged, a translated excerpt from a conservative newspaper, Novoye Vremya, or The New Times, from the 26th. Quote, let us suppose for a moment that the Bolsheviks do gain the upper hand. Who will govern us then? The cooks, perhaps, those connoisseurs of cutlets and beefsteaks. Or maybe the firemen. The stable boys, the chauffeurs. Or perhaps the nursemaids will rush off to meetings of the Council of State in between diaper washing sessions. Who then? Where are the statesmen? Perhaps the mechanics will run the theaters, the plumbers, foreign affairs, the carpenters, the post office. Who will it be? History alone will give a definitive answer to this mad ambition of the Bolsheviks. End quote. In other words, the oh-so-recently former ruling classes made zero attempt to hide their hostility toward the Soviets and the masses, and their classist, elitist language would sound familiar to anyone who has ever seen a clip of Fox News. The forces of the bourgeoisie in this period are sometimes called reactionary forces, sometimes called loyalist forces, and eventually they come to be known as the Whites, in contradistinction to the Reds. But whatever they are called, they were comprised of right SRs, cadets, right and center Mensheviks, Cossacks, and military officers and cadets. That is with a small c, as in officers in training pulled from the nobility. That last group of military officers and cadets are often called Junkers. The term Junker refers to a class of arch-reactionary military officers drawn from the land-owning nobility of Germany. I believe specifically Prussia, a German principality known for its fierce war-making prior to German unification in 1871. This same basic setup of noble-born officers leading the armed forces existed in Russia, which is why you sometimes see this officer class referred to as the Junkers. Anyway, as the new Soviet government was taking shape, these anti-Soviet forces rallied around the Petrograd City Duma. Of course, the Petrograd City Duma had had no national authority within the provisional government. But as the Duma of the capital, it was de facto the next most relevant rung down the ladder of bourgeois government authority. These anti-Soviet forces set up what they called the All-Russian Committee for Salvation of the Homeland and the Revolution, which is usually referred to as simply the Committee for Salvation. As much as the Committee for Salvation was insisting that it was the legitimate government of Russia, the Soviets, led by the Bolsheviks, insisted the Soviet government was the only legitimate governing body in Russia. In a way, then, one might look at this new arrangement and think that the dual power phenomenon, which has persisted since February, is still in effect. And in a purely superficial sense, sure. We still have one side rallying around a provisional government-type authority on the one hand, and an opposing side rallying around the Soviets on the other. But dual power between the February and October revolutions was characterized as two sides roughly equal in strength, a situation which forced concessions and compromises to maintain the delicate balancing act between the two poles of authority. After October, the balance shifted decisively in favor of the Soviets, who took on a much more confrontational, radical, and aggressive stance. The workers and soldiers of Petrograd and across the country had achieved critical mass for class consciousness, and were now intent on taking mastery of their fates into their own hands. The provisional government is gone, and its constituents, in the main, the bourgeoisie, the petty bourgeoisie, and the landed nobility, are now on the back foot, having to react to a state of affairs they never even conceived possible. There are three prongs to the attack that the anti-Soviet forces are about to launch in and around Petrograd, which, along with the fierce and bloody fighting in Moscow, will be the subjects of the rest of today's episode. The first is sabotage in the form of encouraging a general strike of municipal workers to deprive the Soviet government of the means to exercise its new authority. The second is subversion in the form of the Committee for Salvation coordinating anti-Soviet forces in and around Petrograd for street fighting and attempting to weaken the Soviet base of support. The third prong is the military threat, just straight up anti-Soviet troops mobilizing against the Soviets and the Bolsheviks in both Petrograd and Moscow in order to take what had been lost back from the Bolsheviks and then slaughter the lot of them. In Petrograd, the second and third prongs, the Committee for Salvation's plans for subversion and the full frontal military assault on the capital, were supposed to be coordinated to coincide with each other, thus amplifying the effects of each. But, well, we will get there in due time. First, the municipal strike. It was called for and began on the 27th of October. Employees of multiple ministries, agriculture, labor, food, finance, foreign affairs, were joined by teachers, bank clerks, librarians, and telegraph and telephone operators as they all struck in protest of the Bolshevik-led Soviets seizing power, quote, illegitimately. The latter group, the communications workers, were the most critical group to join the strike, since the telegraph was the only way to communicate with the outside world, and the telephones were necessary for Smolny, still the seat of the Soviet government, to communicate with the rest of the city. Losing communications at a time like this presented a particularly grave threat to the new Soviet government, and so comms had to be restored pretty much at any cost. At first, the MRC sent in factory workers and sailors to take the place of the communication workers. But that was when they discovered the equipment had been sabotaged and disabled. After the Soviet workers tried unsuccessfully to get the lines open again, the Bolsheviks put out a placard in front of the telegraph office asking for help in restoring the telegraph lines. Soon, factory workers rallied and, after a tense standoff, they were successful in basically intimidating the telegraphists enough to persuade them to return to their posts and undo their sabotage. As for the telephone lines, John Reed reports that after the regular line operators walked out, quote, only half a dozen trained operators were available. Volunteers were called for. 100 responded. Sailors, soldiers, workers. The six girls scurried backward and forward, instructing, helping, scolding. So crippled, halting, but going, the wires slowly began to hum, end quote. So the striking communications workers were dealt with fairly quickly. The ministerial workers abandoning their posts did deprive the Soviet government of institutional knowledge and experience, but on the other hand, the fact that they were not present to challenge the Soviet commissars as they began to take over governmental functions actually wound up helping the Soviets. All told, the municipal workers' strike actually wound up lasting 78 days. It was not until the 13th of January, 1918, that their strike finally came to an end. Now, some of you may be wondering, wait, I thought the majority of workers were behind the Bolsheviks. Why are some of them now striking against the Bolsheviks and the Soviets? That is a fantastic question. Would it surprise you to learn that the answer has to do with class? The overwhelming majority of the industrial workers were pro-Bolshevik. However, municipal workers were more aligned with the SRs and Mensheviks. Which makes sense if you think about it. They are government workers under the employ of a bourgeois government. Of course, we are talking generally here. The claim is not that every single industrial worker was an ardent Bolshevik and every single non-industrial worker was anti-Bolshevik. But as a rule, industrial labor was so communal and large-scale that it translated very readily into advanced class consciousness. Industry was, after all, the beating heart of capitalist production and development. Municipal workers and clerks, on the other hand, worked in much smaller groups, and the work they did was much more routine and mundane. Their labor was directed at keeping the state operating, in a way, at facilitating capitalist exploitation, and not in actual production of commodities. This is not to say this kind of clerical work has no value or is superfluous. It is not that municipal workers are petty bourgeois, or that their working conditions are never problematic, or that they can never reach class consciousness, or that their material interests lie in maintaining the capitalist system. But this is to say that municipal workers, by virtue of their role in capitalist production, have a much more petty bourgeois kind of mindset. Reed recounts how, prior to the telephone operators striking, a commissar of the MRC named Vishniak attempted to persuade them to stay by appealing to a sense of class solidarity. He tried explaining to these operators, predominantly women, that they were also part of the working class, and that the new Soviet government was one of, by, and for the workers, and so their wages would be increased and their working hours reduced, only to be met with indignation from the operators, who, on average, were more educated and considered more skilled than industrial workers, at being compared to the dirty grunts in the factories and workshops. The thing is, municipal, clerical, office work is fundamentally different work from industrial labor, to the point where the two groups have different starting points in the class struggle. At this point, the municipal workers of Petrograd were still heavily influenced by the Mensheviks and SRs. And so when those party leaders called for a strike and denounced the Bolsheviks and the Soviets, these workers responded. It is here that I want to put a pin in one other workers' union that, as I am sure many of you are aware, exerted enormous influence at this time. The Railroad Workers' Union, known by its Russian acronym Vikzhel, threatened a strike as leverage in the negotiations over a new Soviet government. This was a major concern for the Soviets, since, as we have discussed in prior episodes, the railroads were a dominant form of transportation across the vast territory of Russia, and so a railroad strike had the potential to derail the new Soviet government. Sorry, not sorry for the pun. However, since this was directed more at trying to force a compromise between the Bolsheviks on the one side and the other parties on the other, and since the strike never actually materialized, and since the fight for Vikzhel's support defined a lot of political maneuvering in the weeks immediately following the October Revolution, we will be discussing the impacts of all that in the next episode. But going back to the municipal workers who did end up going on strike, it must be said that their cause was aided by the fact that the majority of papers in Petrograd at this time were anti-Soviet and pro-Committee for Salvation, since the papers were controlled by the political parties that comprised the committee. As the reactionary forces clashed on the streets of Petrograd and the surrounding suburbs with forces of the MRC, the Soviet, and the Red Guards in the final days of October, clashes we will get to next, these newspapers began printing reports that the Soviet forces, the Bolsheviks, and the workers were engaging in looting, indiscriminate shooting and arrests, and were little more than roving bands of thugs engaging in stochastic street violence. There were even lurid and scandalous accusations of the rape of women soldiers who had been in the Winter Palace in defense of the provisional government the night of the 25th, 26th. This was accompanied by open calls to overthrow the newly established Soviet government before it had a chance to find its footing. All this, and especially that last part about inciting insurrection and overthrow of the Soviet government, prompted Lenin and that Soviet government to issue a decree shutting down the presses of the opposition parties. Lenin insisted this was necessary because, given the present circumstances, these opposition newspapers were, quote, more dangerous than bombs and machine guns, end quote. This curtailing of freedom of the press would be a point of massive contention, both at the time in Russia and in historical discussions and debates about how democratic the Bolsheviks were. For example, when the Bolsheviks are condemned, as they often are, for shutting down the oppositional press, rarely, if ever, is it mentioned that this was done only after the press in question openly declared themselves the enemy of Soviet power and vowed to overthrow it. Regardless, we will have more to say about this decree and the role it played in the negotiations to form a Soviet government next time. For now, I will only point out that in a volatile, revolutionary situation where the masses have seized power nominally but have not yet solidified their position, and opposition papers are flooding their readers with calls to violence against the workers and for overthrow of the new order, and are openly discussing the impending military attack on the new government, and calling for violent, bloody reprisals against the revolutionaries after they are defeated? Well, from a realpolitik point of view, I am not going to pretend like Lenin's decree on the press does not make sense. These papers are vowing bloody violence against the masses. Instead of, say, arresting and shooting the lot of them, the Soviets simply muzzled them. Seems a fairly measured response, if you think about it. The majority of the reactionary reporting was classic Red Scare journalism, comprised of repeated failures to investigate and corroborate claims, combined with exaggeration and even outright lying. For example, the charge of rape of women fighting for the provisional government was concluded to be false for complete lack of evidence. However, it must be pointed out that not all the reporting was completely false. Red Guard units contained the most radical and militant workers in the city, and as they were fighting for their revolution, with little to no established oversight from the new Soviet government, some of the Red Guard units did engage in violence and arrests that were later determined to have been excessive. Of course, it did not help that the Military Revolutionary Committee wound up appointing a fanatic left SR as commander-in-chief of the Petrograd forces, and then immediately tasked this commander with defeating both an armed uprising and an invading army, prongs 2 and 3 of the counter-revolutionary attack. It is to those prongs we now turn. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. This show is 100% listener-funded and always will be. Become a Patreon of the Sickle and the Hammer today. There are multiple tiers, each with their own bag of goodies, depending on what you sign up for. Best of all, early access to episodes starts at the Comrade tier for just $5 a month. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. If you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast service you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. When it comes to the insurrection being planned by the Committee for Salvation, the intent was that the officers and cadets inside the city would take back control of key military installations and other strategic infrastructure across the capital. This is sometimes referred to as the Junker Uprising, and was supposed to be coordinated with the assault on Petrograd, led by General Pyotr Nikolaevich Krasnov. We will give our full attention to that campaign in just a bit, after dealing with the Junkers. The Soviets caught wind of the plans for both the Junker uprising and for the coordination of the uprising with the military assault from Krasnov on the 28th, when copies were found in the possession of someone who had been arrested and who, as it turned out, was one of the leaders of the entire operation. In response to the discovery of these plans, the Military Revolutionary Committee in Petrograd declared martial law on the 29th of October and appointed that fanatic left SR I mentioned just a moment ago. His rank was colonel, his name was Mikhail Artyomievich Muravyov, and he was given command of all revolutionary military forces in Petrograd and tasked with defeating the immediate counter-revolutionary threat. Muravyov was the highest-ranking officer available who agreed to take the position, which explains his party affiliation. Very few Bolsheviks were to be found among the officer corps, and why he was only a colonel and not of a higher rank. The reason he is characterized as a fanatic is that, in his attempt to put down the counter-revolution, he issued an order on the 2nd of November, granting broad discretion by Red Guards to engage in violence and even lynchings. This order was another shocking moment for many, as it was feared this was another step in the spiraling of the revolution into wanton violence and civil war. Ultimately, the order was rescinded a few days later by the Soviet government, as it had been issued by Muravyov without consultation with any organ of the new Soviet government, and only after the Junker uprising and Krasnov's military campaign had both been defeated. But the few days it was in effect were enough to lend an air of validity to the accusations that the new Soviets were bloodthirsty villains. But we should back up a few days first. When the Committee for Salvation learned that their plan had been uncovered on the 28th, they decided to stage their insurrection on the following day, the 29th, before Soviet forces could stop them. However, this was a full day before Krasnov was planning on approaching the city. Without the support of Krasnov's advance, despite some initial successes, the Junker forces were ultimately defeated by the forces led by Muravyov. By the late evening of the 29th, some 200 combatants had died in the fighting that day, which was actually far, far more than had died on the 25th. The Committee for Salvation ultimately would continue for a while as an outlawed organization until the end of November, when it joined up with a handful of other organizations to form the Union for the Defense of the Constituent Assembly. But by early January, once the assembly was abolished by the Soviets, spoiler alert, this union and the committee which had joined it effectively ceased to exist. This brings us now to the final and arguably most important prong of the reactionary backlash to the Soviets taking power in Petrograd. The military threat took the form of, as I said, General Pyotr Nikolaevich Krasnov, who was working with the Prime Minister turned renegade, our old friend Kerensky. We last saw Kerensky as he fled the capital late morning on the 25th to try to rally loyal troops to march into Petrograd. At that time, I gave him his full send-off, but mentioned he would have a small coda in the run-up to the Civil War before fleeing Russia for good in March 1918. Well, here he is. Once out of Petrograd, Kerensky headed for Pskov. There, he initially approached General Vladimir Andreevich Cheremisov for support in marching on the capital, but Cheremisov, as it turned out, was one of the few generals in the Russian army who actually supported the Bolsheviks, and so he turned Kerensky down and even threatened to arrest him. Kerensky then met up with Krasnov, who was the commander of the 3rd Cavalry Corps and had participated in the Kornilov affair back in August. Together, they were able to gather a small army of about 700 crack Cossack troops to aid Kerensky in his quest to defeat the Bolsheviks and their Soviets. 700 may not sound like a lot of troops because, Well, it is not a lot of troops. Kerensky lied, or may have exaggerated, about the amount of support he had among the army, which led Krasnov to believe he could expect reinforcements along his march, as well as once he entered the capital. As already mentioned, the combined reactionary forces of Krasnov, Kerensky, and the Committee for Salvation hoped for a quick, decisive, and easy victory that would allow them to return to business as usual. Oh, and if this plan sounds familiar, remember that it was the same basic playbook that Kornilov had tried to run exactly 2 months prior. Suddenly, the Bolshevik fears of a second Kornilovite movement do not seem so paranoid and crazy, do they? Krasnov began his march on Petrograd on the 26th. At first, his forces brushed aside any resistance, since such groups as what offered resistance were small, disorganized, and not nearly a match in battle for the Cossacks. Krasnov first marched on Gatchina, a small town just over 40 kilometers from Petrograd, arriving on the 27th. On the 28th, his forces took Tsarskoye Selo, about 25 kilometers from Petrograd. There were some skirmishes on the way to Tsarskoye, but again, Krasnov and his Cossacks had yet to face anything capable of challenging them in battle, and so the Soviet in Tsarskoye Selo abandoned the town as it became clear that Krasnov and Kerensky would be entering. From there, the plan was to march on Petrograd itself on the 30th and kick out the Bolshevik usurpers. But already there were signs that the operation was not going well. Chief among them was the almost total lack of reinforcements and support Krasnov and his troops received on their march. The garrison at Gatchina had declared its neutrality as soon as Krasnov arrived. A handful of army officers joined Krasnov, but as individuals, they did not bring any troops under their command with them. Once they got to Tsarskoye Selo, the Krasnov troops were able to push out the Red Guards fairly easily, but the army garrison, which numbered approximately 16,000, instead of greeting the Cossacks as brothers in arms, also declared itself neutral. John Reed describes how the soldiers were desperate to avoid fighting, period. They wanted to end the fighting with Germany and avoid, at any cost, fighting fellow Russians. Indeed, as we will see, this was a pervasive desire. Many across the board were preoccupied first and foremost in avoiding an all-out civil war. Then, the attack on the 30th of October did not go quite according to Krasnov's plan. With the Junker uprising having failed the previous day, Krasnov was acting without any support from inside the capital. As his troops were marching up from the south, they met stiff Soviet defenses in the hilly area outside Petrograd called Pulkovskie Vysoty, or the Pulkova Heights. The Soviet government had managed to dispatch Red Guards and regiments of the Petrograd garrison, along with sailors from Kronstadt and Helsingfors, to prevent this enemy from entering the capital. The Soviet forces are estimated to have been about 5,000 all told, which means they outnumbered Krasnov's Cossacks by about 7-1. However, the Krasnov troops were better trained, better supplied, and better rested. Again, they had had what amounts to a leisurely jaunt from Pskov to Petrograd over 4 days, with barely anything getting in their way. The Soviet forces, on the other hand, had been scrambling first to effect the October Revolution, then to put down the Junker Mutiny, and now to fight off Krasnov's Cossacks. They did all this while dealing with the shortages and inflation that had been dogging them for the entire year, and while worrying about the Germans making a move on Petrograd. Because remember, World War I is still happening. The fighting on the Pulkova Heights was fierce, and heavy losses were inflicted by and on both sides. But in the end, the Soviet forces were able to break the Cossack advance and send Krasnov back to Tsarskoye Selo. The Red Guards then chased Kerensky and Krasnov out of Tsarskoye and back to Gatchina, where they then converged on the 2nd of November. There, Krasnov was forced to surrender and was arrested. Kerensky managed to flee, disguised as a sailor. And unlike the apocryphal report that he fled Petrograd on the 25th, quote, in a dress. It appears Kerensky actually did disguise himself as a sailor on his way out of Dodge. And this truly does seem to be the end of Kerensky in our tale. From what I can tell, all that he managed to do until March 1918 was hop from hiding place to hiding place until finally fleeing the country altogether. Again, we discussed his fate in episode 15, so I will not rehash it here. If he pops up in my research in any sort of important capacity, I will bring it to your attention. But with Kerensky's defeat at Pulkovo Heights, coupled with the defeat of government forces in Moscow, which we will address next, this meant that the provisional government was now truly overthrown. Nobody picked up its banner after this. Plenty of white army groups and generals would propose alternatives to Soviet power in their campaigns for the hearts and minds of the Russian masses. But none of their proposals included bringing Kerensky back or resurrecting his government as such. So, yeah. Goodbye, Alexander Fyodorovich, and good riddance. As I've mentioned a few times now, Moscow saw intense fighting in the last week of October, which lasted into early November, and by all accounts, it was the fiercest and bloodiest fighting anywhere in the country at that time. Several hundreds were killed, and artillery was used, which wound up damaging many buildings in the city, including even around and inside the Kremlin. This loss of life, along with the destruction of historical architecture and culture in the old Russian capital, sent even more waves of despair and indignation through the country, and touched off even more calls to stop the fighting and bloodshed. And so, we will round out this episode with a quick run-through of the fighting there. On the 25th of October, the day of the revolution in Petrograd, the Moscow Military Revolutionary Committee was declared by a joint session of the Soviet of Workers' Deputies and the Soviet of Soldiers' Deputies. The Moscow MRC ordered that troops in the Moscow garrison prepare for combat, and that workers be issued weapons. 1,500 rifles were handed out to Red Guards, and MRC forces then proceeded to occupy strategic points of infrastructure and communications. Meanwhile, echoing their brethren in Petrograd, the Junkers and the Moscow City Duma formed the Committee for Public Safety, their version of the Committee for Salvation. These counter-revolutionary forces were headed by the commander of the Moscow Military District, Konstantin Ivanovich Ryabtsev. Ryabtsev was the counterpart to Bolkovnikov, if you remember him from episode 15. He was the guy who oversaw the defection of the Petrograd garrison to the MRC in the days before the Soviet seizure of power. However, unlike Polkovnikov, Ryabtsev experienced some success in maintaining control over his district. On the 27th, Ryabtsev's forces began their operation to wrest control away from Soviet forces, and through street fighting, they took the post office, telephone, and telegraph exchanges. In fact, it is here that we first see the use of the term White Guards to describe these opponents of Red Soviet forces. By 6 p.m. the evening of the 27th, the committee issued an ultimatum to the Moscow MRC to dissolve itself, disarm the workers, and abandon the Kremlin, which was under Bolshevik control. This ultimatum was roundly rejected. The next day, the 28th, Ryabtsev again demanded the surrender of the Kremlin, and declared to the commander of the Kremlin forces, an ensign named Bierzin, that Moscow was under the control of his forces. Bierzin quickly conferred with the troops under his command, which were the 56th Company. At this point, the situation as they knew it was dire. They were completely cut off from everything happening beyond the Kremlin walls, and had zero reason to believe any reinforcements were coming, or that Ryabtsev was lying when he said he had full control of the city. This explains why, after a brief conference, Bierzin and his troops decided to surrender. At this point, what happened next is not disputed, but how and why it happened is. What happened was, the Junkers entered the Kremlin, and the 56th Company was disarmed, and then gunned down. Official Soviet forces, relying on the testimony of a few survivors, report that this was done in cold blood. The men of the 56th surrendered, turned over their arms, then were ordered into a courtyard, surrounded by enemy soldiers with, quote, rifles at the ready, and then the firing began. The Junkers, for their part, later insisted the men of the 56th decided at the last minute to fight and attempt to take back their weapons. Thus, the massacre was a result only of Junkers defending themselves from crazed fanatics. Finally, according to a third version, the Junkers, after surrounding the disarmed 56th and drawing their own rifles, only opened fire after hearing a few random shots coming from somewhere, which spooked the Junkers into opening fire. Which, come on. Neither side is wrong. This is just a tragic thing that happened, so we should move on without holding anyone to account. Really? Sounds like classic liberal fence-sitting to me. For my money, I tend to believe the Soviet version. I will cop to some obvious bias in this, but also, the Junker version strains credulity, whereas the Soviet version is something we will see time and again in the Civil War, as well as generally throughout world history. It makes no sense for the 56th Company to voluntarily disarm, turn over their weapons, and then suddenly, surrounded by hostile forces, change their minds and die trying to rearm themselves. They would have known that, once they turned over their weapons, that was it. Further resistance was futile. On the other hand, reactionary forces convincing their opponents to disarm and then executing them has happened so many times in the history of war and class conflict, it is at this point a trope. Either way, stepping back from the differing accounts, we know for sure that around 300 troops from the 56th Company were killed that day, with only a handful of survivors. After the Kremlin had been taken by the Junkers, the Moscow MRC joined with many of the trade unions in declaring a general strike across the entire city. The rank-and-file workers rallied to this call, and by the evening of the 28th, the center of Moscow was both under the control of the reactionary Junker forces and under siege by the revolutionary forces of the workers, soldiers, and Moscow MRC that now surrounded the center. During the course of the 29th, as the Junker uprising in Petrograd was being dealt with, heavy fighting saw the revolutionary forces in Moscow start to take back the post, the telegraph, and even some of the command centers of the Junker forces. There was an attempt at a 24-hour truce, but neither side held to the conditions. The fighting continued for days, with both sides receiving reinforcements on the 31st. The Junkers welcomed 150 soldiers from the 7th Strike Battalion from Bryansk, whereas the MRC welcomed over 500 sailors from Petrograd, who had come after defeating Krasnov's forces up there. The 1st and 2nd of November saw the artillery used as the Junker forces, realizing they were losing, became more and more desperate to beat back the Reds, and the Reds became more and more determined to finish the fight. By the evening of the 2nd, many of the Junker divisions had surrendered, but it was not until the 3rd that the final divisions were defeated. The evening of the 3rd, Soviet power was declared in Moscow. As we close out this discussion on the rise and defeat of the counter-revolution in the two largest cities of Russia, it is worth asking, what accounts for the differences we observe between the two cases? Specifically, why was the overthrow of the government a relatively straightforward, almost procedural matter in Petrograd, whereas in Moscow, it took over a week of fierce fighting with heavy casualties to decide who would be in control? Tony Cliff provides some answers. He points to a whole series of material differences between the two cities. Petrograd was much closer to the war front, and so throughout October, the threat of German invasion was real. Moscow, on the other hand, was miles from any active fighting. Moscow's garrison was not as large, and due to the absence of an immediate threat of invasion or being dispatched to the front, the garrison was not as ardently pro-Bolshevik. The proletariat of Moscow at the time was also not as militant. Petrograd had by far the largest industrial factories in all of Russia. The Putilov works alone employed thousands of workers. Moscow had no factories as large, and so the proletariat was less concentrated, which translated to a less militant attitude on average. What was more, the socialist revolutionaries managed to maintain significant influence among the Moscow workers well into October. The Bolshevik-Menshevik split in Moscow had also never seemed to be as sharp and acrimonious as in Petrograd. The two parties in Moscow still related to each other almost as if they were simply different wings of the original RSDLP from 15 years ago. Also, it did not help that the Bolshevik leadership on a national level was almost entirely preoccupied with events in Petrograd. This meant that the Moscow Bolsheviks were in many ways neglected compared to their Petrograd comrades. The Petrograd Committee of the Bolshevik Party was by far the largest and single most important branch of the entire party. The Moscow Committee was important, but not as important. Due to the lack of attention from the more militant wing of the party leadership, especially Lenin, and because of the generally less confrontational attitudes between the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, the leaders of the Moscow Bolsheviks, most notably Nagin and Rykov, wound up being allies of Kamenev and supported him in his more conciliatory stance toward the other parties and the government. As such, as the revolution unfolded in Petrograd that week in October, they were slow to make open declarations that would antagonize their opponents too much. All of this explains why there was no military revolutionary committee in Moscow until after the Bolsheviks had seized power in Petrograd on the 25th. Even when it was formed, its executive committee was led by four Bolsheviks, two Mensheviks, and one member of yet another one of those seemingly infinite number of small groups I keep coming across. The Mensheviks in the Moscow MRC openly stated that their intent in joining was, quote, to soften the effects of this senseless Bolshevik adventure, end quote. In other words, they were there to prevent the MRC from taking decisive action against the government forces. This, combined with the hesitation of the Moscow Bolshevik leadership in nipping the counter-revolutionary movement in the bud, provided that movement with the room it needed to maneuver, and almost outmaneuver, the Moscow Soviet. I want to be clear, though. I am not saying that the Bolsheviks in Moscow were weaker than in Petrograd, or less committed, or that the workers there were less capable. It was just that the crisis that had developed under the regime of dual power in the capital of Petrograd was not nearly as sharp in Moscow, for all the reasons we just listed. If Petrograd served as the epicenter of the earthquake that was the October Revolution, the tectonic shifts were felt much less acutely over 700 kilometers away in Moscow, and that is over 400 miles for us Yanks. As for the Junkers and their counter-revolutionaries, I think it is worth noting just how ferocious and dangerous they were in their quest to take back power. If there are a slew of explanations for why the Bolsheviks in Moscow differed from their Petrograd comrades, there is no real reason to think that the Petrograd Committee for Salvation would not have acted similarly to the Moscow Committee for Public Safety, had the former been given the room to maneuver. In other words, the Bolsheviks acted quickly and decisively in Petrograd, and so the fighting was brief, controlled, and casualties were kept to a minimum. In Moscow, the Bolsheviks hesitated, forming their MRC much later. Their opponents took full advantage of this, and in the end nearly succeeded in preventing Soviet power from taking root, all at the cost of many more lives and damage to the cultural heritage of Old Rus. I mentioned at the start of this episode that there is a compelling argument that the delineation I am making of this supposed interim period between the 25th of October and the start of the Civil War does not make sense. I am using this framework of events as a way to keep everything straightforward as we progress through the narrative. However, many people consider the events in Petrograd and Moscow we have just discussed to be the start of the Russian Civil War. I, for one, am not inclined to argue with them on this point. Although it will be a while before the scale of the fighting reaches the level that we normally associate with a full-out civil war, when it does, the difference between that fighting and the fighting in Petrograd and Moscow turns out to be largely a difference in degree, not in kind. We already have the whites and the reds fighting each other. The Civil War is just that, but with full-blown armies instead of urban guerrilla fighters. Still, if someone makes the case that the Civil War does not start until those armies are formed and fighting, I am not inclined to argue with them either. The question is, as they say, academic. As for the defeated reactionary forces in Petrograd and Moscow, interestingly enough, the Bolsheviks showed a remarkable degree of clemency toward their defeated adversaries, which ultimately came back to bite them in the rear. Starting with the cadets in Petrograd, many of those who had been in the Winter Palace when the provisional government was overthrown on the 25th and the 26th were not arrested, and they wound up taking part in the Junker uprising on the 29th. Some of the Junker leaders in Moscow were shot after the conclusion of the fighting there, but many of the Junker troops were not. These troops subsequently left Moscow and joined the various white armies to continue the fight against the Reds. Even Krasnov, who was arrested on the 2nd of November in Gatchina and brought to Petrograd, was released on house arrest on the 10th after giving his word not to leave the city, which he did almost immediately to take up a post in the civil war against the Bolsheviks. Years later, Viktor Serge, a prominent Bulgarian-born Bolshevik, wrote in his memoirs about this period, decrying the foolishness of the clemency of the Bolsheviks. I myself am not inclined to consider the clemency from the Bolsheviks to be a mistake, other than probably in the case of Krasnov. Punishing the leaders only and letting the troops go on promise that they will not take up arms again is something that armies have been doing for thousands of years, and can actually be quite effective in preempting further fighting. If others who have taken up arms see that, upon surrendering, only the ringleaders are held responsible and everyone else gets to go back to their lives unmolested, they are more likely to do that. If, on the other hand, they know that surrender only gets them all executed anyway, they will fight to the last man. But the counter to that is that the Bolsheviks probably should have known better. These Junkers were not hapless farmers pressed into military service who did not really have anything to fight for, and so would take the first opportunity to put down their arms. They were part of the ruling classes, who were facing the complete negation of their social, economic, and political dominance, and so actually, they had everything to fight for. Either way, even if Bolshevik clemency was a mistake, which, again, I do not think it was not an especially grievous one. The Junker fighters from both cities were small enough in number that they cannot really be said to have influenced the outcome of any battles in which they subsequently participated. We are talking here mostly about a few hundred, a few thousand at most. Of course, that is not nothing, but it is a tiny fraction of the millions who ultimately would be mobilized against the Reds in the Civil War. But again, the only one who probably should not have been let go was Krasnov. His story turns out to be kind of a wild ride. I may dig deeper into it at some point, but for now, I will summarize that he not only flees Petrograd to lead the Whites against the Reds, but after being defeated again in the Civil War, he flees to Western Europe, and ultimately winds up becoming a rabid anti-Semite, allying himself with the Nazis in their quest to exterminate the threat of global Jewry and socialism in the Soviet Union, and leading Cossack divisions against the Communists under the banner of Nazism. At the end of the war, he is taken into custody by the British, who hand him over to the Soviets. He is put on trial for his crimes against the Soviet Union and sentenced to death. He was hung at Lefortovo prison in Moscow on the 16th of January, 1947, at 8:45 p.m., at the age of 77. So, yeah, that one is maybe definitely an oopsie. You let the troops go, you hold the leaders fully responsible. Next time, strap in, because we will be staying mostly in Petrograd and following Lenin and the Bolsheviks, both the more radical left wing and the more moderate right wing, as they maneuver around both each other, the other parties, and third parties like Vikzhel to determine just what the new Soviet government will look like. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars: Big Easy H, Bryce Holder, Cage 433, Kat Brannigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathenes, Jay, Jack, Josue Ponce, Nicodemus, Rasmussen Svensson, Ryan Fowler, Sam McGeever, and Zach Wheatley. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.